At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History Hotline, the hottest line for all things Black history and beyond.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 59 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook, and I'm your host today. If this is your first episode, then welcome, and I hope you learned something new today. And if you are joining me once again, then welcome back. Thank you for returning to learn more about all things Black history and beyond. So today's episode, as you know from the title, is about the Colston Fall. Edward Colston, the statue, it's coming down. Did it need to be dragged down? That is the question we will be asking today. Now, it's a very, not controversial topic, it's a very fresh topic, shall we say. Because if you're listening to this in kind of real time when it was released, it's only a few days after the Colston Four were found guilty of like criminal damage and pulling down the statue, even though they definitely admitted to pulling that statue down. Based on some very interesting techniques, tactics from the defence, they were found not guilty. And I think it's a very interesting case, and I thought I'd want to talk about it today. But I think also that I've never done an episode on Edward Colston, and I don't think I would actually want to give him a whole episode because of the person he was, and obviously he was a slave trader. And I just feel like it's glorifying him in a different way to statues, but it all the same it is. So, you know, I'm going to give you some context and history about him just so you can understand maybe why they were found not guilty and why the kind of case went the way it did, and the kind of history in Bristol as well, and why that statue was such a big problem for so many people. Because, you know, even people that may not have agreed with statues coming down would have potentially argued that that statue needed to be removed. Maybe not in the way it was taken down, but it needed to go. And Bristol had a history of campaigning for that statue to be gone. So this was kind of the culmination of a lot of things, including the Black Lives Matter movement of summer 2020. So we're going to get into all of that today, starting with a little bit of history on Edward Colston, talking about how long Bristolians have wanted the statue to come down, how it came down, where is it now, and then the case of the Colston Four. Edward Colston, who was he? He was born 1636 and died 1721. He was an English merchant, philanthropist, and Tory member of Parliament who was involved in the Atlantic slave trade. And I've taken that directly from his Wikipedia page. Now, I'm not sure if it said who was involved in the Atlantic slave trade pre-2020. I don't know. But that's what it said when I checked. And it's interesting because a lot of people just wanted Edward Colston as a historical figure to be contextualised in, you know, within the context of him being a slave trader. And, you know, now it's taken kind of all this for that to happen because I didn't know who Edward Colston was pre-2020. I'd never heard of him, I can't lie. Good or bad things he'd done. However, I knew of places like Colston Hall and some of the other kind of schools and things that were named after him, having no understanding of who he was, which I think is, for me personally, the problem when we don't contextualise these historical figures and actually have honest discourse conversations about who they were. Because human beings are human beings, not to justify his involvement in slavery, but I think in kind of any case, there are going to be people, historical figures, that have problematic sides. Edward Colston is beyond problematic. I'm not even trying to suggest that, but, you know, there needs to be more conversation, is my point, about the good and bad of people. People aren't just all good or all bad, you know, they're not just heroes and villains. I think there's a spectrum and people fall kind of someplace on it. Edward Colston is a villain. Sorry. I can't see him as anything else. and I'll get into his life. So he followed his father in family business, becoming a sea merchant. We're thinking about the 1600s here, so, and the, yeah, an early 1700s, where trading in all the kind of new European ports, whether that be Spain, Portugal, was very common. His family traded in wine, fruits, and textiles, and then later people. So by 1680, he became involved in the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, this is, as a member of the Royal African Company, which actually held the monopoly on the English trade in African enslaved people. He was actually deputy governor of the Royal African Company from 1689 to 1690. Now, that's a very high position. That's not just, oh, I owned some enslaved people. This is, I was deputy governor of the company that had a monopoly on trading human beings, kidnapping them from their homelands and transporting them halfway across the world. He's deputy governor of this. So this isn't just no small time situation here. Now, the Royal African Company, for those of you that don't know, was a merchant company set up in 1660 by, as it's called, the Royal British Crown, the Stuart family at the time, and the City of London merchants, to trade along the west coast of Africa. It shipped more enslaved African people to the Americas than any other company in the history of the Atlantic slave trade. So not only is Edward Colston just involved, he's involved in the biggest slave trading situation set up of all time. He's not small fry, is my point, and I'll stress this a lot. The Royal African Company were also responsible for the extraction of natural resources from the continent, primarily West Africa, such as gold from Gambia, petroleum, sweet crude oil, natural gases, and gold especially. The Royal African Company provided gold to the English Mint, and the English Mint are the people that make the coins for the whole of the UK. All coins made with this specific gold were designed with a little elephant below the bust of the monarch, whether that be the king or the queen at the time. And this gold also gave the coinage its name, the guinea, which was obviously used in the UK, after the region in West Africa where the gold was taken from. So not only were they so brazen in their theft of natural resources, they named it after the region that they'd stolen it from, and they, I mean, the British Crown, and used it in everyday language. So everyday British people, you know, paying with a guinea or being charged a guinea for something, that was actually a direct reference to the theft and extraction of natural resources in West Africa. And I think this just kind of highlights just how acceptable this would have been. Because a lot of people have spoken about, you know, within the context of the time, what Edward Colston was doing wasn't seen as a bad thing, essentially. It was what not everybody was doing, but it was what a lot of people were doing. And if you've got the British Crown with their hand in the extraction of gold and natural resources, as well as people, you know, how can you then turn to Edward Colston as if he should have been on a higher moral compass when the British Crown itself are invested in these activities, not to justify anyone's behaviour at all, more to contextualise it and give you kind of context of what was happening at the time. Anyway, back to Edward Colston. So, as I mentioned, 1680, he becomes a member. The Royal African Company rises up to deputy. And, you know, during Colston's involvement with the Royal African Company from 1680 to 1692, it's estimated that the company transported over 84,000 African men, women and children to the Caribbean and the rest of the Americas, of whom as many as 19,000 may have died on the journey. Now, as we know, with transatlantic slavery, things were recorded because enslaved people were seen and treated as no more than property. And just in the same way that you have items in your house that you might insure, contents insurance, they would insure their property, human beings, enslaved African people. And so numbers would have been recorded, and I'm speaking on the accuracy of these numbers, basically. So numbers would have been recorded, but not always the most accurate, because There's obviously room to lie, there's room to miscount, there's room for people to escape. And when it comes to deaths especially, I think there was a lot of kind of misquoting numbers and just, right, you know, trying to get the most money from people that might have died. So, you know, whilst we have those numbers, I would say you can go more or less to get the real impact. But regardless, even with the numbers we have, to know that as many as 19,000 may have died on the journey, let alone those who then made the journey and then died in just the worst conditions imaginable, it really just kind of gives you the extent of what this man was all about. Just a disclaimer here, I absolutely despise and hate talking about slavery. Like, I hate it so much because it's just a horrible time in history, and I hate thinking about it, I hate studying it, and I hate talking about it. But I had to get into this because I didn't know about Edward Colston, and I figured if I didn't know, then you might not know. So here we are, educating people. But honestly, this episode is just not the history I like to do. So we're going to fast forward through this very quickly, and I'm going to tell you about what this man did with all his money he made from these enslaved people exploiting their lives and labor, and, you know, why there was a statue made of him, essentially, knowing all of this about him regardless. So Edward Colston, I don't know, stops working with the Royal African Company or whatever. That's not very accurate, but he essentially isn't the deputy director person anymore. He's a Tory high churchman, often in conflict with the Whig Corporation in Bristol, and he transfers a large chunk of his money and shareholding to William III, also known as William of Orange, who was King of England 1689-1702, and this secures the new regime's favour of the Royal African Company. So essentially, you know, bought off the king and said, here's some money, so that they would support. The value of Colston's shares increased. He didn't have children, so he began to donate large sums of money to charities. He withdrew from the company in 1692, but continued working on his private businesses until he retired in 1708. Then he was MP for Bristol from 1710 to 1713. He essentially used his money to support schools, houses for the poor, almshouses, hospitals, churches, Anglican churches in Bristol, London and elsewhere in the country. And his name features a lot on many Bristol buildings, landmarks, because of this. He used his money and his power to promote his religious beliefs, which was High Anglicanism in the Church of England, as opposed to kind of Roman Catholic beliefs. And it's a whole religious thing as well, but it's not relevant for this episode. And whilst we don't know how much of his wealth came exactly and directly from the trading of enslaved African people, or whether it came from his other businesses, private businesses that he ventured into after or before he got involved with the slave trade. So this is why people are a bit like, well, you know, not all of his money was, so maybe not every single building was kind of, the wealth for that wasn't created all through slavery. However, I think, you know, when you think about money, if you have a bank account and you have a salary coming in and that salary is from dodgy dealings or the slave trade in this case, and it all goes into one pot, and then you have a private business, and you know you have that money from slavery in the bank, which is obviously either a cushion to fall back on or money to invest in future businesses, it's all rolled up in one, and it's all rolled up in his character and his moral compass. So I don't really like this idea of separating out, oh, well, not all the money would have come from slavery. No, that's not the point. It's not the point at all. It's estimated that he spent the equivalent of 5.5 million in 2020 money on kind of Bristol and charitable institutions, which, when you think about the fact that 5.5 million in 2020 money is still a lot of money, and the fact that then obviously translate that money to whatever the currency was in the 18th century, early 18th century. That's a lot of money. And that is the kind of wealth he was getting from the work he was doing. So when you think about it, all that wealth that African people were not compensated for, they were used, they were exploited, they were abused, and this is the kind of consequence of this. This is their money. It's their, you know, the fruit of their labour. He did nothing for it. The Colson Society, this operated for 275 years commemorating Colston in its kind of latter years as a charity. It decided to actually disband in 2020. But this is kind of the legacy of this man. And I think this is enough on him, but we will think about now the statue. And I just need people to remember at this point that the statue is not him. It's a statue. It's a piece of metal crafted to look like him, but it's not him. Because I noticed that when people were talking about that statue being taken down, thrown into the river, it was as if he was thrown into the river. He wasn't thrown into the river. It's just a statue. Real African people were thrown into the sea, not him. And now for our second section, how long have Bristolians wanted that statue to come down? Now, the statue was originally erected in 1895, which is 174 years after Colston's death. And for context, around 30 years after the end of slavery in the kind of British colonies, and around 90 years after the end of the actual slave trade. So the first thing to be abolished was a trade of enslaved people, well, of people to then make them enslaved. And then in around 1830s was the end of slavery within the colonies. There was a 6-year, 7-year period of apprenticeship in most of the islands, most of the Caribbean islands. And so that's why I don't give it a specific date within the region of the 1830s. So it was in this time where, well, 30 years later, that this statue was erected. Now, in Britain, if you've ever studied slavery at school, you probably studied abolition, and people like William Wilberforce have come up a lot. And their kind of abolition movement really started, obviously, well before the end of the slave trade. So this feeling and the sentiment of abolition and slavery now being seen as a moral wrong would have been in public consciousness from the start of the 1800s. 90 years later, this statue appears. So it's not like this statue was erected during a time where slavery, even within society, was more acceptable. It's even less acceptable at this point. You know, as we think about the way we feel about certain topics, whatever they might be, in society, you know, stigmas get removed and we start having conversations about things, and as time goes on, things become more or less acceptable. It was the same with slavery, and the fact that this statue goes up in 1895 to me is quite shocking because of the context of the time and the fact that slavery has been abolished at this point. So it was seen as a moral wrong, and that's the narrative that's pushed and the agenda that's pushed when you learn about slavery in school, is that people finally started to see it as a moral wrong. The church and kind of bodies like that for an abolitionist movements were started up in order to kind of, you know, yeah, fix that moral wrong. So how is it then that 30 years later a statue goes up of this man that was essentially deputy director of the Royal African Company and responsible for the enslavement of so many African people? That's what gets me, I think. And I don't know too much about the erection and why it was needed at that point. All I know is that it was designed by a man called John Cassidy, the statue that is, and put up in the centre of Bristol to commemorate his philanthropy. His slave trading activities were apparently uncovered later. So there is this idea that people didn't know or didn't know the extent. And it wasn't until 1920, a man called H.J. Wilkins wrote a biography of his life and uncovered these slave trading activities. And then since the 1990s, there's been calls for this statue to be marked with a plaque stating he was a slave trader or to be taken down. Because that original plaque that was on the plinth next to his statue celebrated him as, and I quote, one of the most virtuous and wise sons of Bristol. So it wasn't, you know, until 1920 that it's believed that we as society really know about Edward Colston's activities as a slave trader. And that comes from a biography that's written by H.J. Wilkins, as I mentioned. Now, interestingly, as I mentioned, and it was kind of brought up a lot in articles I read, his involvement in the slave trade obviously predated the abolition movement, and this is just used to justify the fact that he can't be seen as a baddie because his involvement was before people saw it as morally wrong in British society. I think that's a bit... I'll reserve my words because I don't want to make this an explicit podcast, but I think that's a bit crap, really, because at the end of the day, there were abolitionists. Whilst the movement wasn't big, there were abolitionists throughout the whole of slavery. There were people that knew this was wrong, and there were enslaved people, formerly enslaved people, that were fighting for this to end throughout. So, nonsense to me, but that's a justification that we've been given. Okay, so since the 1990s, with increasing recognition of Colston's role in the slave trade, there has been more and more critique and calls for, you know, this commemoration to be actually contextualised and the points about him being a slave trader be included. The Dolphin Society, which was formed to continue Colston's philanthropy, now actually refers to the evils of slavery and also recognises, and I quote, that black citizens in Bristol today can suffer disadvantage in terms of education, employment and housing for reasons that connect back to the days of transatlantic slave trade. I find that very interesting because not many people are able to link the two. The fact that disadvantages within black communities and black people today in Britain is directly linked back to the slave trade. The link is long and it's not for today's episode, but the link is there because whilst, and the quote, oh, I'm going to forget it, but the quote is, whilst slavery was not born out of racism, rather racism out of slavery. Now, the point is, there have been so many different types of people enslaved for different reasons, black, white, Asian, North African, South African, like... Slavery and the concept of having slaves is something that, you know, you read the Bible, it dates all the way back. No one is saying that they weren't as bad. You know, the situations of being an enslaved person is terrible, whether you're thinking about modern day slavery, transatlantic slavery, any other kind of slavery. Personally, I think it's, you know, you're still in a position of subordination, and I don't think human beings were created to be that. So the fact that we have to remember this transatlantic slave trade is the only time really historically where people are taken from their homeland as black people, as African people, sent to all corners of the earth and literally stripped of their cultural identity, their languages, their hairstyles, their foods, their cultures. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir, but the fact that it becomes about race because all the people that are being taken are African people, i.e. black, and all the people that are enslaving them, give or take, are white, European, or later on American. Of course, there were black people that were enslaved, we know this. I don't need to hear that. Someone always says it when you talk about slavery. It's not relevant to me because the numbers are so small, but it's also not relevant because there was still a racial element to it. As I said, slavery wasn't born out of racism. It wasn't a thing of like, we're going to take these black people because they're black. It was, we're going to take these people because we want free labour. And then the racial implications came later down the line, whereby you are literally taking people and their culture, putting them into these new lands, and then you have created a society, a two-tiered, two-layered society, where black people are at the bottom of it and white people are at the top. It created a racial divide in so many different societies, American society, in the Caribbean, in British society as well, to a lesser extent. And that has created the precedence for the way that certain races of people and classes of people have been treated today. And I'm happy that that link is made by the Dolphin Society in this statement, linking transatlantic slave trade to the disadvantages of Bristolians, black Bristolians, today, in the modern day. It's a link that needs to be made and understood more freely, because then people, I feel like I won't hear people go, oh, yeah, can't you forget about slavery? It was so long ago. No, you can't, because the implications and the consequences of it are still seen today. Anyway, that was a lot. This is why I don't like talking about slavery. It gets me really mad and I'm really holding back, but I'm trying. We're going to get back onto this statue and why it was there and what the 90s were all about. So 1998, there's an article in the Times, and I can't get the article. I couldn't access it. I couldn't, like, find it when I was doing research for this episode. But the headline was Graffiti Attack Revives Bristol Slavery Route. 29th of Jan, 1998, written by Emma Wilkins. And the article, I'm assuming, just based on the kind of context in which it was spoken about, is talking about the fact that there's a graffiti attack on Colston statue, I believe. And it is kind of bringing up the conversation, the row, about Bristol and the kind of links to slavery and potentially Colston. And so 1998, we can see that people are understanding the problems with this statue. And I also wanted to stress, you know, this is the 90s. This is 30 years ago. So it's clear that the calls for this statue to be contextualised or removed have been going on for a long time. That's my point. So in 2018 now, I just want to go over a few instances of kind of people that are pushing back against Colston's legacy in Bristol. Because it's been a long battle, I think, for a lot of people there to just no longer have to see that statue. So in 2018, Lord Mayor of Bristol, a lady at the time called Cleo Lake, she's a councillor for the Green Party, and Lord Mayor is not the same as Mayor. Lord Mayor is like, the role gets kind of passed around to the different political parties, I believe, whereas a mayor is elected, like the London Mayor, essentially. So Lord Mayor of Bristol, Cleo Lake, ordered that a portrait of Colston be removed from her office because she said it would, she would not be comfortable sharing it with that portrait. She wouldn't be comfortable sharing the space with a portrait of a slave trader. Cleo Lake is a mixed race woman of Scottish and African descent. And that portrait was removed. She'd previously tried to remove statues and symbols of Edward Colston in the city. And she actually also spoke at the Colston 4 trial. She also admitted that, and this is taken from one of those ugly, smelly tabloids, but she admitted celebrating the toppling of Colston's statue, like many of us, on June 7th. And she was also, and I quote, shocked, alarmed and startled when she discovered a portrait of the slave trader in the London Mayor's parlour and tried to have it removed. This is obviously when she was Lord Mayor in 2018. So again, this is predating George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, 2020 movement, and the fact that, you know, these conversations are happening, people know what this man is about and don't want him representing their city. And so, especially I think for Cleo Lake, as a mixed race woman who might have been the descendant of enslaved people, I don't know, I don't want to put that history on her, but you know, we can't be sure. Similarly, Marvin Rees, who is the mayor now, not the Lord Mayor, the actual elected mayor. He's actually the first black person to be elected as a mayor in any European city, not just the UK, all of Europe. And so it's interesting that he was actually mayor at the time of this statue coming down. And I watched a documentary, I did share it on the Instagram page of the History Hotline, called Statue Wars. And it was all about following Marvin Rees in the 3 days after the Colston statue came down, looking at the ways that the far right then retaliated to that. They smashed the grave, the actual resting place of a formerly enslaved African young person. So, you know, not only, as I mentioned, the Colston statue is not a real person, it's a piece of metal, but the resting place of a person is actually real. Do you know what I mean? The heads, that person lies there in the ground, and that was damaged. He was sent hate mail. He was sent death threats. His house was on kind of a terror alert. The police had to be really vigilant in, whilst they called it, kind of categorised it as low risk, there was still a risk to the safety of his wife and his children. He woke up one morning with Marvin Rees needs to die on the pavement outside of his house. The documentary it's not about him. It's more about Bristol more widely, but because they follow him around, you really do get to kind of understand what he's going through, not personally so much, even though I've given you the personal examples, but his response as a government official, you know, he can't really condone the statue coming down. Like, politically, I feel like the politically correct thing was kind of him trying to toe the line of saying, yes, we do not want this to be the legacy of Bristol because this man is involved in the slave trade. And yes, it is not the law that you can just pull down a statue that you're not happy with. But also knowing that that statue should have probably come down a long time ago. So it was kind of a hard line for him. He faced criticism on all sides, from other councillors that were saying he wasn't doing enough. And then a lot of white Bristolians that were not about the quote-unquote wokeness, that felt like, you know, that statue should never have come down and he should have done more to not necessarily protect it, but condemn them after. So yeah, it was a hard job for him. Not that this is about him, but I just found it really interesting that Bristol having a black mayor, having to then kind of deal with all this. It fell on a black man to deal with all this fallout. It was very interesting. And some of the hate mail he was receiving, oh my life. I'd urge you to watch it. It's very, very interesting. Marvin Rees himself actually tried to have it taken down in the past. But he does acknowledge in the documentary that, you know, there are so many other bigger issues facing, you know, disadvantaged people in Bristol, that taking down a statue, yes, while it's a very big symbol of a potential change to come, it doesn't change anything. It is merely symbolic. And when it came down during the protests, it didn't feel more than symbolic, not to criticise it, but it could only be a symbolic gesture. It could only be a symbolic move. It was beautiful symbolism to see his statue go into the river, Edward Colston's statue. But that's not going to fix racism. That's not going to fix discrimination. That's not going to help people that have been disadvantaged by this same slave trade, however many hundreds of years later. And he really was trying to push that message. And the media outlets that were interviewing him, they weren't getting it. They were asking, like, really silly questions about the statue and then counter protests and stuff like that. And he just wanted to kind of get down to the fact that, look, there is a problem with racism in this city and we're trying to fix it, and the statue is neither here nor there. So that was another interesting point. But this is me talking a whole podcast episode about the statue, so we've got to get, you know, into the statue a little bit more. How did it come down and where is it now is our next section. So June the 7th, 2020, a few days after the murder of George Floyd, where we started to see protests in UK major cities, as well as obviously in America and other parts of the world. The statue was toppled. It was toppled by so many people and pushed into the Bristol Harbour by protesters. And I believe that the Colston Four were kind of the only people that they could identify. And hence why they were arrested and charged, because they were not the only four people that did it. And I think that's another reason why I would not have been happy if they'd gone to prison for it or something. Found guilty of. Because they were not the only ones. It's very clear by every single piece of footage, they're not the only ones. They were the only ones that could be caught. And whilst you still have to obviously, you know, charge people if you do catch them, it would have been like they were made an example of, even though they weren't the only ones that did it. Now, it was pushed into the Bristol Harbour, and then it was retrieved. I don't know why, like, I can't lie, I did find it really funny seeing it go in. It was just like wild to me because I'd seen statues come down in America of like slave traders in the years previous. And again, like they were massive statues being pulled, dragged down. Like the strength of angry people, of raging, fuming people to pull down a whole statue, that is something. And it was something so important. And I'm glad I was alive to see it, you know, in the flesh. Not in the actual flesh, it wasn't in Bristol, but on the telly. Anyway, the Merchant Venturers Society, who kind of formed from when Colston was around, said it had been inappropriate for them to have become involved in the rewording of the plaque, which was another thing that was happening in 2018. And so that the removal of this statue was right for Bristol. I'm not sure if they agreed the way it was done, but they did believe that it was right for it to be removed. And this is a society that Colston was kind of involved part of. So very interesting for them to kind of come out and say that. But from the 4th of June 2021, so last year, a statue was put on display. In its damaged condition, it had red graffiti on the hands, and I hope that symbolised blood on the hands. The English lit student in me was looking for the metaphors and the symbolism. There was graffiti all over him. I think it said Black Lives Matter on it as well. And it was interesting, the documentary actually went to the statue and the people that were restoring it, and they weren't restoring it to its original form, they were restoring it to the form of its damage. They were kind of restoring the paintwork on it so that that red paint that's on his hands and on his face will stay there, because they were saying that because it obviously was in the harbour for so long, the paint started to chip off, and they wanted to make sure that that moment in 2020 was remembered. And people were still kind of saying when it had gone into the river and then it was, sorry, into the harbour and then taken out, that it should go back up or something, or it should go up in a museum. And it didn't go up in a museum, it was down, it was lying down when it was displayed in Bristol's M Shed Museum. They had a temporary display, I think it ended at the end of 2021, and they didn't make it into like a big exhibition, it was kind of just there. They said it was a temporary display and it's the start of a conversation, not a complete exhibition, which I thought was quite good. I don't think it needs the power of a whole exhibition. We, Bristolians anyway, have seen it. They've seen it for their whole life because it's been up there since 1895 and there's no one still around from 1895. So yeah, the fact that it's kind of in a museum lying down with all this graffiti on it to remember this historical moment and not the historical moment of him being a glorified philanthropist, I think is very important. So that's how it came down. The Colston Four, Jake Skuse, Rhiann Graham, Milo Ponsford and Sage Willoughby were the ones arrested and charged. Obviously not the only ones that did it. They played apparently key roles in the tearing down of the statue and dragging it into the Bristol Harbour and throwing it into River Avon. I didn't know it was River Avon. You learn something new every day. And this obviously, you know, started up conversations again about Britain's imperial past. We were talking about Churchill. People were even talking about Gandhi, whether we should have statues of them. Admiral Nelson and all these other people. You know, do we need to contextualise their lives and talk about the negative, racist, imperialistic things that they said and did, as well as the quote-unquote good things they did? So it was very interesting that this statue coming down was able to kind of trigger these conversations. And I think that was probably one of the most important things from what happened, you know, on June the 7th. The trial itself, the trial of the Colston Four, was only last week. And I just found the strategy of the defence so interesting, because in my mind I was like, when these people had been charged, I was like, there's absolutely no way, if they're caught on camera pulling the statue down, they cannot be charged with pulling the statue down. But like, it's, I don't see why, I don't, this is a big opinion, I don't see why they would go to prison for that, because I just feel like, personally anyway, prison should be for people that we can't have in society because they're too dangerous. I have other views about prison that I'm not going to share on this podcast episode today. But for, you know, for what we have now, I just feel like those people are not a threat to society. They're not, you know, a danger to the public or themselves. So just putting them in prison is a waste of taxpayers' money in the bare minimum form. So I'm happy, obviously, they were found not guilty, jubilant even. But this is the kind of strategy that the defence used. So the Colston Four, as they were named, through their own legal arguments and their eloquence as young defendants, to be honest, placed history at the centre of the trial. Witnesses that were called on were a charity worker, Lloyd Russell, 65 years old. His family arrived in Bristol from Jamaica in the 50s. He compared living in the diversity of St. Paul's, a place in Bristol, to the Bronx in New York. And he talked about the fact that he'd gone to a mostly white grammar school. He'd first faced racism at the age of 11 at a time he just didn't want to be at school. There was vigilante groups throwing things through his window in his family home. His father was a proud black man, as he described. And, you know, took his mom to a place called Broadmead and people spat in her face. And, you know, this was him talking about the realities of living in Bristol in the 50s as a black boy with black parents and a black family. And that's the kind of evidence that they used. David Olusoga, historian, he actually brought the evidence that I gave you at the start about Colston, about his fortunes that he made as a shareholder in the Royal African Company and as a slave trader, kidnapping and enslaving around 85,000 Africans, including 12,000 children. He brought all this as historical evidence. And I just find it fascinating and fantastic that history was at the centre of this trial. Like, the way I spoke about the Mangrove Nine in the first ever episode, I feel like this trial, once maybe we can get more trial records and things like that, will be spoken about in a similar way. Whilst there won't be the racial element of the Colston Four, there were four white people, it will be a very different kind of situation when we think about it. But I love a good trial, me. So this was very interesting to me. So David Olusoga, he spoke as well. Cleo Lake, who I said was the Lord Mayor of Bristol in 2018, she also was called upon to give evidence and just talk about the kind of state in Bristol and the history of Colston and this statue and his legacy and what it's meant and how it's been a point of tension for so long in Bristol. They were found not guilty. They all came out in their Colston 4 t-shirts that were created by Banksy. And he only did, I think, a limited amount of them and gave them to, like, small businesses, record shops and stuff in Bristol to sell. You couldn't get them online. You had to literally listen to this, like, I think it's a Juma radio. It was like a Saturday morning, and they would tell you where that t-shirt was going to be sold that day, and it was sold in like five shops across Bristol, and it was first come first serve, one per person, to support their case, essentially. Big up Banksy for doing all of that. And they came out in those t-shirts jubilant because they'd won the case. And a lot of people on the other side of the political spectrum who were in disbelief and the precedents that this will set, and it is going to set a massive precedence. I don't know how many other statues are just going to be felled and come down and be dragged into rivers. And I'm not saying it should happen. I wish that the conversation would move beyond statues to actually fighting discrimination and improving the situation for some disadvantaged groups, marginalised groups within society, especially black people, in this context. Statues are a big part of how we understand history, but they're not the only way. And I think we could have all the statues of all the kind of evil people in the world up, but if we understood them to be evil people and we had that history and knew that, then I think there would be less of a problem. But the issue that most people have, and rightly so, is glorifying these historical figures in a false light that is not really justifiable is problematic. And that is going to be all for me on this episode. I just want to leave you with the point that statue of Edward Colston was pulled down, and across its 17th century robes is scrawled BLM, Black Lives Matter. And let's be honest, black lives did not matter to this slave trader in the 18th century or the 17th century, but they had to matter to him and his statue as he ended up in the river in 2020. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a wonderful week. Goodbye.